Welcome to Season 15 of the Art of Teaching podcast. I'm Matthew Green, and I'm so grateful that you've joined me today. Before we get started with our discussion, I would like to acknowledge the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of this land on which I'm recording, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. I acknowledge the stories, traditions, and living cultures of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples on this land. Today I have the pleasure of sharing a recent conversation that I had with Dr. Shyam Barr. Shyam helps educators foster students' metacognition and self-regulated learning. His research explores professional learning approaches that support teachers' thinking and practice around self-regulation. We also talked a lot about his new book, Educate to Self-Regulate, Empowering Learners for Lifelong Success, which you can pre-order using the link below. This is the second episode that we've recorded together, and each time I walk away with new insights. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation with the amazing Dr. Shyam Barr. Dr. Shyam Barr, welcome back to the podcast. It's lovely to see you. What's been happening since we chatted last time?
Hey, man, it has been far too long. too long, right?
It has.
I was trying to think about when we last caught up, and at least in person, it feels like over a year. Is that right?
Yeah. And a lot can happen in that time. And before we hit record, you mentioned that you welcomed a son at the beginning of the year. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, a little boy.
How's it going?
He was born in September, so he's 7 months old now. Yeah. He's actually following a similar path to our daughter in the sense that our daughter was an early walker. She started walking at 9 months.
Right.
Crawling. And we thought we would have the pleasure of seeing him crawl, but he seems to be bypassing that as well.
Yeah. So that definitely happened with our second one. I think she just was used to seeing her sister stumbling around the place and decided just to go straight to walking. So yeah, we thought we'd have a bit more time, but how's it going? What's life like being a parent of two? Has it changed you a lot?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, everyone said once you have two, it really it's quite the step up, and I'd say legit more than anything. Like we knew, and Matt, I imagine it's the same for you. You know what you're doing, but logistically, it's just that little bit more challenging because now there's you know, two adults, two children, and so you really you know you're playing a bit of a one-on-one game in some regard. Whereas previously, just with one child, there was always that moment of me being able to, you know, duck out for something like a school event. Or even just to the gym, and my wife, you know, I wouldn't feel guilty because my wife would only have one child at home, but leaving her with two, like that's quite a large ask these days, particularly because we've got such young children. Yeah. And so both of us, and we're very open about that, but navigating the guilt that comes with the logistics of two children.
So how's that sort of changed the way that you structure your day? I know for me, if I'm going to go to the gym, it has to be stupidly early, so it doesn't impact the rest of my family. But is that similar to you? Has it changed the way that you organize your day? Because you seem to be someone who is extremely productive and achieves a lot. But has that shifted somewhat, being a parent of two?
Cheers, mate. Yeah. Well, you know, to be honest with you, I feel like I've been adapting strategies and processes and structures for the last 3 years, and like I've been doing it for most of my life, but particularly since children. Our daughter was born during COVID, so you know, going to the gym was a home gym, and it was easy enough for me to just get up in the morning, quite early morning, and just work out from home. Yeah. And I think I even have videos of me at one point, you know, with her in my arm and me with a dumbbell in the other one, like just doing bicep curls just to get the reps in. Whereas with our son, you know, it's, we're not in COVID. We, you know, we're not in the same kind of environment. And so I don't have a home gym at this new place that we're living in. You know, we have a little bit of a setup in the garage. But now, like, I still get up early. Now, actually, to get to the gym, I actually go on my lunch break. Or I try and do it after drop off. So, you know, when I drop off my daughter at daycare, I duck to the gym for a quick hour session. And it just means that I start work slightly later on those days. But you just kind of navigate it. So I have to admit, I feel like my gym sessions now are probably getting carved out of my workday. But it means that I'm more productive in my workday to try and make up for that time.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And I used to stay at work pretty late. And so I would, after school, I'd get my marking done. I would sort of leave at sort of 6, sometimes 7 o'clock at night, which is very late. You obviously can't do that anymore when you've got kids. And so for me, it's really changed the way that I approach my day and also the things that I commit to, because I used to say, I think I'm a recovering people pleaser. And I used to say yes to everything and then regret it the night before of that particular commitment. But now I always ask myself, if this thing was on tonight, would I want to go? Because I think it's really easy when you look in the future and say, in 6 months' time, I've got heaps of time. Like, yes. I've got nothing on. Of course I can do that. Of course I can go away for a boys' trip. Of course I can. I'd love to. Nothing's happening. But like I said, I always ask myself, if that was tonight or tomorrow, would I want to go? Could I be bothered? And usually the answer is no, because as we said before we hit record, those that matter most are at home. And so, yeah, it's sort of dramatically changed the way I think I approach things. But Shai, just wondering, has your coffee order changed since we last had a conversation?
It hasn't. You know, I'm still a green tea. I'm an avid green tea drinker. I've, you know, maybe I've got a little fancier since our last chat. A friend of mine recommended, and yeah, you know, I'm not affiliated with T2 at all, but a friend of mine recommended the Buddha Tears.
Right.
They're these little like balls of tea leaves.
Yeah.
And you know, you pop them in your water, and after a little while, like, they unravel, and you just get these kind of beautiful leaves in your green tea. Anyway, I say, you know, I just enjoy the sort of the slow process of, you know, popping them in there and just sort of waiting for them to, it's just a reminder of sort of be present, enjoy the moment, and relish kind of the slow life.
Shai, about the importance of being present, you seem to be someone, every conversation that I have had with you, you seem to be incredibly engaged, and you seem to be really, really focused, and you're a really great listener. Is that something which you've sort of developed, or is it something which you think comes naturally?
Thanks, man.
I always walk away from our conversations going, oh, I want to be a bit more like that.
I think you are like that. You know, it's interesting that you pointed that out. It's such a lovely compliment. So thank you. It's something that I actually really strive and work hard to be a good listener, to be present and focused in conversation. Something that I struggle with children, actually, because having conversations with my wife now, you know, they're constantly interrupted by children. And so sometimes I feel like I can never be fully present in a conversation with my wife while my children are around, because at the same time I want to be fully present for my children. And so I find myself just battling with that. But I'd say it's something that I've worked very hard on. And what I mean by that is, and I don't know if I mentioned it last time, but you know, I get up every morning and I meditate for at least 15 minutes to help ground my mind and actually start my day with a level of focus and presence, so that I'm actually not starting my day in a reactive mode, but in a very proactive mode. The other thing that I do is before, and I've spoken to teachers about this, it's kind of a modified pre-commitment strategy, but sort of at every transition point in my day, so you know, whether I've just come home from work and before I get out of the car and I come into the house, I'll take a moment to write, whether it's in my phone on a, you know, note, or just in, I have a little notebook that I carry around with me, and I'll just make a note for how I want to show up, basically what my intention is for how I want to show up in the next activity. So, you know, okay, I'm just about to enter the house and be with my family. How do I want to show up for them? And, you know, it could be as something as simple as, you know, I want to be really present for them for the next 3.5 hours before I, you know, jump on the call with Matt. And, you know, what does that mean? That means that I'm gonna close my laptop. I'm gonna put my work stuff straight away upstairs in my office so that it's not gonna be pulling on my attention at all. And so I think I actively connect with my intention before I actually engage in the activity. And I think that helps me then stay really grounded when I'm in the activity.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there's so much in that, isn't there? I mean, I think it takes an incredible level of self-awareness to detach yourself from how you're feeling, and it could be stressed or anxious or nervous or tired or hungry or whatever, and actually sort of step outside of that feeling and say, okay, how is it that I want to show up for those, like I said, for in the next meeting or in the next interview. And it seems like you do it easily, but I would imagine that there are some times where you don't show up the way that you should. How do you sort of bounce back from that? Do you say sorry quickly, as we tend to do in our family, sorry quickly and often?
I love that. Oh, you know, it's interesting. I actually, so, you know, what we're talking about here is self-regulation, you know, how we self-regulate as, self-regulate our focus, self-regulate our listening skills, our communication skills. I very much believe that self-regulation is a practice. It doesn't matter how much knowledge we have and how much awareness and all the strategies, we can have all of those in the world. But there are a range of environmental factors that influence our ability. And so you're absolutely right. There are some days, doesn't matter how beautiful my intentions are, I will not show up in the way that I wanted to. I don't beat myself up over that. You know, if an apology is needed, absolutely, I apologize. But I just take that as a moment in time that, if anything, it's an opportunity for me to go back and sharpen the short saw. Yeah, because I just tell myself, you know what, self-regulation is a practice. This is a daily deliberate practice. Some days, you know, it will work out in my favor, and some days it will not. But my commitment is to practice it daily.
I one of the quotes that I find incredibly confronting, but I also try and live by, is a quote by, I think it's by Jim Rohn, and he said, "What's it like to be on the other side of you?" And it's really, really confronting, because I know that today I was a bit cranky at my wife, and I didn't want to hear that response from her. I actually didn't want to know, because I knew it was probably a bit painful to be on the other side of me this morning when I was sulking and dealing with my grown-up emotions. But I think it's a good reminder, isn't it, that we are often the way that we are received, and the way that we are. The way that we engage with others really does matter. And so I try and ask myself that question as often as I can, especially in meetings, because it's very easy, I think, to go to the next thing and to just move on, especially when you're in an environment that requires a lot of decisions and a lot of consequences. But what I've tried to do, I think, as a leader, is just, I guess, slow down a little bit, and ask my team, did I listen during that interaction? And I've got a little Google form at the front of my office, and I get all the kids to basically rate me on from 0 to 10 on a number of different criteria. And one of them for kids is, "Mr. Green listened to me. Mr. Green helped me solve my problems. Mr. Green helped me feel safe." And I get the kids to rate it. And quite often, if a kid's been in trouble, the rating is brutal. But at least it is a type of feedback. But Shai, for those people that are not aware, can you just give us a brief history of your career in education? And I'll link our previous conversation in the show notes. But for those people that are listening for the first time, tell us about how you got to where you are today, and what were some of those key milestones?
Mate, I would be happy to share that, but can I just say that's so beautiful what you just shared with me about your approach as a leader. Actually, I hope you don't mind that I'm taking notes as we talk. I'll be learning more from this than you will be from this conversation, I'm sure.
I think I probably stole it from someone, and I think it's quite often those things that are hard to hard to calculate and hard to quantify that are really, really important. I mean, we talk a lot about in my team, like, kids are probably going to forget the content that you're teaching them, but they are going to remember how you feel, how you made them feel.
Yeah.
And so we've tried to come up with a way as a team and as a school of how do we quantify some of those qualities. So that's just the way that we do that. So it's interesting. And always, like, I think about it as well as a parent. I always ask my kids, like, do you like being in this family? Or what can I do? What can I do to make you feel special? And today, this morning, and this is my wife's idea, but we just went and sat in a cafe and drew pictures and colored in with our six-year-old. She just wanted to sit with her parents and draw pictures. And I think I had this moment where I was sort of sitting back, and like I said, I was a bit cranky, but I remember sitting back going, wow, this is actually everything that we had ever hoped for and prayed for right here. It's sitting down as a family, coloring in, having a coffee. This is heaven. And so I think I'm really trying to, I feel like I'm really trying to slow time down so that we can appreciate those moments a little bit more. But yeah, ask the people that matter most. What's it like being a kid in this family? What's it like being a student in this school? How can I help you? So,
yeah. And it's beautiful to see you, I feel like you're translating, but transferring maybe even just some of what we do in schools into your, you know, call it family practice. Yeah. And I find I do the same, is, you know, I'm constantly thinking about what I'm learning about in terms of a teaching and learning scenario, or, you know, self-regulated learning and things like that. And I'm thinking about, what does that mean for me as a dad? Mm. What does that mean for me as, a parent who's in a family what does that mean for my communication with my wife and the way that I function with my children? It's so beautiful to see you actively thinking about that, reflecting on that. And, you know, not everyone's open to feedback, but here you are actively inviting it.
Thank you. That's very kind. And I think it's important, isn't it? Like, if you ask for feedback from someone, and like I said, there are moments that I do this really well and moments that I don't do it well at all. And today was a mixture of that. But I think if you're going to ask someone for feedback, like, actually listen to the feedback. Like, you don't have to agree with it, but there will, unless it's just purely defamatory, there will be some thread of truth in that feedback.
Thanks, Matt. Well, I should answer your actual question, which was how did I get to where I am?
Oh, that's right. Sorry, mate. Yeah.
To cut a long story short, I originally qualified as a teacher when I left my undergrad degree. I worked actually as a science teacher and a school leader for 9 years.
Wow.
Overseas and here in Australia. And then I embarked on a bit of a research journey. I started studying a PhD, and I finished a master's by research, and I then continued into a PhD, both in the field of self-regulated learning, or I guess cognitive psychology and educational practice. And it really just fueled an obsession. I call it obsession, but it's a mission, really. It just made me realize how important that field of research was, and how important it was for educators to have the knowledge that I have been developing and continue to develop. I think, you know, I remember when I was, it was probably my sixth or seventh year full time in schools, when I was introduced to the field of self-regulated learning more formally. Like, you know, we had touched on it in, you know, the AITSL standards, or in, you know, the Victorian Essential Learning Standards, or,
yeah,
you know, in my undergraduate degree, but never at the level at which that I sort of discovered it when I was in my seventh, I think it was my sixth or seventh year of teaching. And, you know, I was one of maybe eight educators it was at Melbourne Girls Grammar. Mm-hmm. So I was working there. I was probably in my third or fourth year there. And, you know, imagine just, like, you know, you take your best teachers in the school. And I was, you know, so grateful that I'd been picked as this sort of group of eight to be part of this partnership with Flinders University to dig deeper into this, the field of self-regulated learning and how we could actually translate that into school practice. Wow. And I remember probably 6 months in or even sort of a year in, the group of us just kind of looking around the table and thinking, how did we not know this?
Mm.
We're considered reasonably effective practitioners in our school context. And how did we not know this? How did we not have this knowledge? And we realized we were so early on in that journey that many of us actually went on to, you know, either finish the graduate certificate, finish a master's degree, or in my case, and I'm probably one of two or three that went on to do a doctoral studies of that eight. So yeah, wow. Fascinating.
So why is it? So, and actually we might start with what is it and why is it so important? Why was it for you a moment that the penny dropped and you went, geez, this is really important?
I was a science teacher, and I think up until that point, you know, I valued relationships. You know, I was very keen on effective pedagogy, and, you know, I had really good relationships with my students. And like I said, my students, I think students are your biggest advocates, and my students advocated very well for me. I often got very good feedback. What I realized when I first started studying the field of self-regulated learning was that I'd been focusing on perhaps the wrong thing.
Mm.
You know, I had originally been teaching science. Perhaps I used to even say that, you know, we don't teach subjects, we teach children, we teach young people. And so I'd floated between those two kind of pieces of language. I teach science and I teach young people. And then when I discovered this field, there was a moment in my practice. I can't remember exactly when it was, but there was a profound kind of shift in my belief system where I went from seeing science as my subject to seeing science as a vehicle in which I could teach kids how to learn. And so it was, my subject became, I teach kids how to learn science as opposed to I teach kids science, if that makes sense. And that very nuanced shift was a game changer. Like it really, really challenged. And it's a bit like what you were saying in the way that you're approaching practice at your school is like, how do you approach some of these skills that are much harder to measure? Because you know they're so valuable. And that became, I guess, the essence of my mission was, okay, how do we teach this? How do we measure it so that it actually becomes the core priority of what we're doing?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Ishai, you seem like there's just so much happening in your life. Like I don't look at a lot of people's Instagram as much as I do yours. Now that may sound a little bit creepy, but you always seem to be doing something really interesting. So whether you're podcasting, in fact, I remember having a conversation with you about launching your amazing podcast. I believe it was with you and Rory, and I was in a car park. I was driving to the airport and I pulled over and I was in a car park. I remember having a conversation with you. I think it was both of you at the time. And just hearing your passion for self-regulated learning. Somehow you managed to have an academic career and publish papers. And also you've written a book. I don't know where you find the time, but tell me about why on earth would you decide to write a book, and why now? Because it seems like a real labor of love.
Yeah, particularly why write one when you've just got a newborn? That's a really valid point. So once I finished my PhD, and you're right, I did publish papers, journal articles, academic book chapters, and I worked as an assistant professor of learning sciences at the University of Canberra. And then actually, you know, a couple of years ago, I started having some pretty hard conversations with our dean in the Faculty of Education at UC about the responsibility and the purpose of educational research. And, you know, we had some really good conversations. Barney Delgano, who's the dean there now, and I have a very good relationship. And long story short, it was very, like, I had won multiple awards at the university. I'd won multiple grants, had outstanding feedback, et cetera. I was on a the assistant professor track is like an accelerated track for
big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal, you know, in terms of, you know, those who can meet the criteria. It's a fast track to being an associate professor. I felt that that's great. You know, I can play the game, you can meet the performance criteria, but what's the benefit in those criteria if it's not translating to practice? And so the book really has come about through that lens of knowledge translation. How can I get some of the complex research that I read and unpack into the hands of educators in a meaningful way that they can actually use in practice? And so a year and a half ago, I sort of planted the seed. It was on my, you know, one of the many post-it notes that I set for myself. You know, I wrote down that I wanted to write a book and I started to map out the path. I had no idea how to go about that. I was like, where do you even start? There's this self-publishing, is publishing, like there's so many questions to be answered. And so I went on a bit of journey last year to unpack and learn how to write a book. And in October or September last year, I actually signed with Amber Press to write this book. And the deadline was actually very hard, like in the sense that it was a September, October signing to a January deadline. So I had like four or five months to turn this book out. And thankfully, you know, I've done a lot of research in this field and I had a lot of kind of the thinking already there. So what actually my task was to bring it together into a meaningful kind of piece of work that would be accessible for educators. And well, Matt, you were one of my reviewers, one of maybe 21 reviewers. The publisher actually said to me, you know, get 3 people to review it. But I'm a big believer in get feedback early, get feedback often. I, you know, from the minute I sort of had even a rough draft of a few chapters, I started sending it out to people.
It was like great. It really was, like, in the sense of it was really practical. And one of my, I guess, frustrations with academia, respectfully, is there does seem to be a real gap between like theory and practice. And one of the many reasons why, 3 years ago now I started this podcast, was to try and sort of bridge that gap between what's happening in universities and what's happening in people outside of the classroom and those which I think are doing the most important job in society, which is actually standing in front of kids. And so I loved your book and it was so practical. And there were so many times that I read it and I thought, like, I wish I'd thought of that. Like, it's so simple. I wish I'd thought of it. And then also there were a number of times in that I was having conversations with a colleague and I was like, we're doing that. We are doing that thing. It's part of reflective practice that's embedded in our teaching and learning cycles in New South Wales, or there's definitely highlights in there. And so it was both a thumbs up to some of the great things that our teachers are already doing in class, but also a reminder of what's possible. But it was hugely practical. I mean, the amount of conferences I've sat in and gone, firstly, what's for lunch? Because I'm hungry. And second thing is, what is this going to mean when I stand in front of my classroom tomorrow? Because I've got to do something. Yeah. And so I think your work was, you can tell those that have had experience in the classroom and those that haven't. And it was a real refreshing read. So congratulations. Yeah. And when do you think we'll see it on? When's it coming out?
So the official publication date is the 19th of June. It's actually my 40th birthday.
On the 19th of June?
19th of June. Wow. So it's due out on the 19th of June. I'm hopeful actually to have, so pre-orders are already out now. So, you know, any of your listeners who are interested in pre-ordering a copy, for sure visit my, can I say this, Matt? Is that okay? Can I
do a little? Of course. And I'll put all of the links to that in the show notes. But yeah, please feel free, plug away.
So just shinebar.com. If you jump on there, you can go to the little store on my website and have a look and pre-order the book. Yeah. So the pre-orders have been available now for 2 weeks. There's been so much interest, which has been fantastic, not just here in Australia. Like, most of the interest has been here in Australia, but there's quite a bit of interest coming from Switzerland, Germany and the Netherlands, interestingly, which is really, really cool. Basically, I'm hopeful to have some hard copies in my hands by the end of May, which means that I'll be able to start fulfilling those pre-orders ahead of the actual publication date, which kind of means that anyone who places a pre-order could potentially get their copies, you know, well before the book is officially published, which is kind of cool. You know?
Yeah, that's really cool. You should do a road trip, a book signing road
Book.
trip.
Yeah. I mean, if you think there's interest in across the at least the east coast of Australia, it's definitely on my list.
But Shai, that's a huge accomplishment. And like I said, you're an avid podcaster, and I listen. I learn so much from your conversations that you have on your podcast. And like I said, I'll put the link to that in the show notes. But how was this different? And why didn't you just stop at podcasting? Why did you have to do something a little bit more permanent and write this book? Because it seems like is it a different sort of medium, a different type of approach? But yeah, why put this in book form?
There's so much to self-regulated learning is really, really complex. And our podcast episodes are only 20 minutes, and
Yeah,
we can
that's right.
unpack these kind of small snippets. But what teachers are often like, every workshop that I run, teachers are always like, where can I find out more about this? And so the book was in essence responding to A, the number of questions that I get from educators about self-regulated learning, and B, to meet that need of where can I get more information about this? And there hasn't I've never I've got a range of resources, not necessarily mine, others as well, other authors, but nothing that's kind of been perfect or hit the mark. And so this book was in essence trying to fill that gap that I've been aware of through the workshops that I run with teachers to try and meet that need.
Tell me about your book. What can we expect from that?
So it's interesting. I pick up educator books all the time, and one thing that I've noticed, actually, I picked up one recently where I flicked through. I haven't read it, so I won't say the name of the book or the author, because it's only an initial impression. But I picked it up, and just through flicking through it, I noticed there was no reference list, and there were no obvious in-text references. And my first, and I don't know if it's the academic in me, but my first gut reaction to that was, how can you write a book for the education profession that isn't grounded in evidence? I feel like as a consultant, as an academic, as a teacher, like I have a responsibility to the profession to make sure that I'm contributing to the evidence, based and evidence-informed discussion that we're having.
Finally.
And so originally when I wrote this book, it was actually very academic, hand on heart. Like it was probably more a quality journal article of sorts. And the first feedback that I got was, it's far too academic, and like it's just, I feel like I'm reading a precursor to a university text or something like that. And so it took a fair bit of reworking to make it much more accessible and meaningful for educators. And I hope through the 21 reviews, the iterative cycle, it has got to that point. But there's the book really is three sections. The first section is what I've called Foundations of Self-Regulated Learning. And it's really unpacking, just for those who aren't familiar with it, the what and why of self-regulated learning. What is it and why is it important? So that's the first section. The second section is the largest of the book, which is all about instructional approaches for self-regulated learning. So how do we teach it in classrooms?
That was my favorite section.
Awesome. Okay.
It's so useful. Sorry, mate. So the middle section is kind of like how to and what that looks like.
And the third section really is pitched more at leaders in school. So whether you're a middle leader, senior leader, et cetera, or someone who's going to be leading a school improvement initiative about self-regulated learning in your school, because you don't have to be in a formal leadership position to have that responsibility. But if you're going to be leading a school improvement initiative about self-regulated learning, then the last section is for you, because that's really how do we lead something like this in schools? And it's so interesting because the leaders who have reviewed my book have loved that section. And so it's almost like I feel like I've written parts of the book with slightly different educators in mind, depending on where you are in your educational journey and professional journey.
I love it. I definitely I found the instructional component, so that section two. For me, I think I'm pretty practical. And it comes back to that conversation we're having before. Like, what does this actually look like when I stand in front of a classroom tomorrow? Because I'm trying to think of my lesson now. And so I found that really, I guess it's for me, it's the primary school teacher at heart. That will always be my craft. But also the section three, I think all the sections were great, but section three, the leaders in schools was awesome as well, because I've been in a leadership position for about 9 years now, and I'm constantly thinking about that process. So how can we become better leaders? How can we better self-reflect on our practice? What's it like to be on the other side, on the other side of us? And so I loved it. And I felt like the book really took me, it took me through a journey of getting a really solid understanding of self-regulated learning, and then showed me some of the practical ways, and then also showed me what's possible in terms of the leadership space. And it was a great read. And I'm not just saying this, mate, but I highly recommend it to people that get a copy. It was, yeah, really good read. Was it? What was your favorite section to write?
You know, it's the leadership section probably came the easiest.
Yeah.
Which sounds really funny, but it's probably representative of the work that I'm doing with multiple leaders across schools across Australia and internationally. And so perhaps documenting those stories and documenting those journeys came the easiest. But I wouldn't say there was necessarily a section that I, you know, what was really nice was almost codifying my knowledge around the teaching approaches.
Love that.
You know, I have so many ideas, but when you have to actually structure it in a way that, you know, for a reader to be able to walk through, I have to think about, okay, well, if I was teaching this, how would I, like, what's the first step that I need to know if I'm going to be teaching self-regulated learning? And so, you know, I use a really simple framework in the book where I talk about, you know, as a teacher, we want to identify, modify, and monitor. And so, you know, we want to identify where our students are at with their self-regulated learning and identify their point of challenge. And so the first chapter in that part two is about how to identify where your students are at with their self-regulated learning. Yeah. And then I think, you know, what's that? Chapters, yeah, so that would be chapter three. So chapters 4, 5, 6, and 7 then are all about, well, what do we do once we've figured out where they're at? Where do we start in terms of modifying our practice and intervening with them? And so that was really fun to actually organize that knowledge, because I had it and I'd done so much work with schools. But to actually think about, well, hold on, where do these approaches sit and how do I organize this so that a reader, a teacher, can pick this up and go, right, actually what I want is chapter 5. That's where I need to be. Or chapter 7, yeah, actually classroom climate for self-regulated learning. That's what,
yeah,
I need.
Yeah. And I felt like it was a book that you can read cover to cover, but also go back. And what I didn't get to do is go back and reread it, which I definitely will, because I think there was so much in that. And I think each chapter seems like it would speak to you at different points in your teaching journey, or even different points of the term, depending how stressed you are. Yes. But I love that it's also, it not only takes you on a journey of defining what self-regulated learning is to then sort of taking you through those three sections, but it also, I think, is a really great reference tool as well. So you can dip back in and go, what does this mean for my classroom? What does it mean for this? And so I think it's really well written. I think I scribbled all over the draft that you sent me, and I took so many notes that I couldn't read it. I had to reprint it. Congratulations on getting it almost out into the world. It's a huge accomplishment.
Mate, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And, you know, my sort of deepest purpose with the book is really that it's a benefit to educators. And so I know a publisher will probably see it as a fixed entity, but I don't, like, you know, and that's that perhaps is the difference between me and a publisher mindset, is that, you know, the book is a representation of my thinking knowledge to date, and that as my ideas and partnerships with schools evolve, that I, you know, I trust and assume that my ideas will continue to evolve. And so, you know, treat the book as the current snapshot and not a fixed entity. It's not the be all end all for self-regulated learning. It's simply a starting point.
Yeah. Have you thought about doing an audio book?
It's funny, because I would love to do an audio book. If you know, what I need to suss out really is if enough educators would want to listen to it as an audio book. I think, you know, Amber Press do a print and an ebook. But audiobooks are, you know, if you want that, you have to.
It's a completely different medium, isn't it? Like, there's some books that I, for example, I can't listen to fiction books on audio. I know some people can, but I kind of lose the plot. I also can't listen to particularly complex, research heavy articles on Audible or audio. So it is a different medium, but who would you, if you could choose a celebrity to do your voice for the audiobook, who would it be? I mean, your voice is great, but who would you choose? I'd go Morgan Freeman for me. I think that would be great.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The sort of the wise boy. I feel like Denzel Washington would be probably out of the blue.
Yeah, how can you beat Denzel Washington? Shai, I was just wondering, is there an area in your life that you feel like you are currently under investing in? It could be personally, professionally. Is there something in which you're trying to kind of get the wheels back on?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'd say my health is probably I wouldn't say it's been compromised. It's probably not at the level that I like it to be at in terms of my sleep and my commitment to the gym. As you know, Matt, when you've got two children and those logistics, you just have to make modifications. And so, like, I've currently dropped down the number of times I exercise at the gym from 4 to 3 times a week to navigate and manage all the other things in my life. I still play field hockey, but I don't train. I just play the games on the weekend. And so, you know, while I would love to be training 4 times a week and going to hockey training every week, the reality is that my family is my priority right now. And so my health just has to, it's almost like I'm managing my health, but I'm not pushing it to peak levels, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It does. For someone who has got two kids that are a little bit older, I think it does get easier. We've got our anniversary coming up this week, and we're sending our kids off to their in-laws for the night. And this is the first time that we've been able to do this. And so there's a mixture of nerves and excitement. But I think it does get to the point where you can come up and breathe somewhat. And we are sort of just beginning to experience that, where you kind of have to learn how to re-engage with each other, because it becomes quite a quite functional when you have little kids. And so we have rules around what we can and can't talk about when we're out on a date. So finances, school, and kids are off. Everything else is, how are you going? And so, it does get a little easier. But you're right. I think one of the things I'm learning as well, and back to your description of weeknight field or weeknight hockey training, is a yes to something is actually a no to something else. And so for you saying, if you were to say, yes, I'm going to go and play hockey, it would be a no, I'm not going to be at home to support my wife, to put my kids to bed. And so I'm constantly kind of juggling that, whether I used to just keep committing to more and more things, but then I didn't realize that there's actually a cost to that commitment. And for me right now, being home and putting two little treasures to bed and having half an hour on the couch with my wife is more important than other things. But you sort of become that person that you didn't think you would when you have kids, and you go, oh, okay, I'm now that person that, yeah. But I think, it's tricky, I think, to find that balance.
I love that that self-talk statement, really, whether it's self-talk or self-questioning. But I often say the same thing. You know, if I say yes to this, what am I saying no to?
Yeah.
And so it's part of that self-regulation, being really aware. And I think you're 100%, it's not just health, but relationships take a hit. I find myself saying to friends, like, my wife and I have a really great relationship and we're very good communicators, but how do parents that don't have strong relationships and aren't good communicators navigate young children?
Because, totally. My parents were single parents. We moved to Australia from England, and I think, geez, how do you do that? How do you have a career? How do you pay bills? How do you raise a family? How do you do it on your own? And I think my admiration for people that do that has dramatically increased. I think, gosh, you are superhuman. Shai, I want to be respectful of your time. I'm aware that it's close to 9 o'clock on a weeknight. It would be amiss of me not to ask you about any kind of productivity hacks or tools that you have or tools that you are currently implementing. Is there anything that you're trialing that has the potential to change your life?
Yeah, you know, I'm always playing with
you're always tinkering with something, and I'm like, this guy. So is there anything that you're using at the moment that you sort of kind of got your attention somewhat?
Yeah, before I get to that, actually, I was going to say, Matt, because we were talking about the logistics of life. And I was just thinking, it's so interesting when I was early on in my teaching career, before, you know, marriage, before children, I was really gung-ho on trying to achieve everything that I could in the days that I had. And now I find myself saying, you know, I'm 40 years old, I'm, you know, almost 20 years into my career. And I find myself almost going, like, if I do everything now, there'll be nothing left for me.
Totally.
In 20 years time. So it's almost like Rome wasn't built in a day. And, you know, if I don't get it done today, that's okay. You know, I'm in the long game here. Just keep at it.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I've definitely learned the importance of like longevity. And so the power of doing three really important things each day over a decade, compounding is significant. Yeah. And so I think for me, I'm sort of holding these two tensions between I've got all the time in the world because I plan on doing this for the next 20 or 30 years, but also I don't. So sort of this like tension between the two. And for me, like really prioritizing what are those wins for the day and then switching off as much as you can. But yeah, any tips or tricks or anything that you're, any new apps that you're trialing or anything?
I won't say apps because I've been playing with a few, but they're early days right now. But I've been rereading Deep Work by Cal Newport.
Yeah.
Have you read that book, man?
I have. He's on one of my wish lists to come on the podcast. It's quite amazing. And his podcast, I think it's Deep Questions, is phenomenal. Sorry, I cut you off. Cal Newport, Deep Work. Go, you've got me.
Well, I agree with everything I think you were about to say. So I've been rereading Deep Work, and it's been really, really important for me because in the hustle of life, I found myself between sort of the book hype and, you know, just social media and, you know, just, you know, LinkedIn posts kind of blowing up and things like that, you know, in a really good way. I was getting sucked into this kind of reactive game. And I started rereading. I always, whenever that happens, I'll go back and revisit some of these books. So, you know, some of my favorite books, Essentialism by Greg McKeown, and Deep Work by, you know, Cal Newport. And I always find when I go back to those, I go back into that zone of kind of focus and I recalibrate everything. Everything changes again. And so I've just kind of brought back in, which is, you know, one of my favorite routines, but it's just some, you know, these are tools and strategies that sometimes fall by the wayside in the daily flow of life.
Yeah.
Really using my Outlook calendar, almost like religiously, like, you know, just being so true to it in, I don't do to-do lists. Anything that has to be done, if it can't be actioned, like, you know, it's that notion of touch things only once. If I can action it in the moment, great action. And if I can't, think about how much time it's going to take me and make time in the schedule. So put it in the schedule somewhere. And I think that gives you a real sense for the shortness of time.
Yeah. Have you read, and this is someone else who I've got coming on the podcast, Oliver Berkman, 4,000 Weeks?
No.
It will, I don't say this often, but it will change your life. And he is a philosopher from England. Like I said, I emailed him and I thought there's no way he's got to be so busy. There's no way. He got back. He's such a generous and kind individual. And his book, 4,000 Weeks, basically if you live to 80, you have 4,000 weeks on earth.
Wow.
You're about to turn 40. So if that doesn't put things in perspective.
Yeah.
And so it's this sort of like, and me too, I'm turning 40 at the end of the year. And I can't believe it. And my wife's now put me on a skincare routine. And so, yeah, anyway, but it is both terrifying, but also incredibly uplifting. And so I would highly, highly, highly recommend that book. And also Cal Newport's new book, Slow Productivity.
Man, I appreciate those recommendations. I've written them both down.
Yeah. Last question for today. I feel like this has been just a wonderful conversation, a wonderful way to just catch up. I'm in awe of the work that you're doing. But if there was someone that's listening to this who's a actually two questions. I might edit that a little bit. First question is imagine we were sitting down having a I was having a coffee, you're having a green tea, is that right?
That's right.
We're sitting down, and I'm a graduate teacher. I'm about to step into the classroom for the first time. What advice would you give me about creating an environment in which self-regulated learning really thrives in my classroom?
Oh, that's a fantastic question.
Very long question.
No, you know, it's something that I was told in my first year of education, which I think, you know, funnily enough, is perhaps the foundation of where my kind of obsession started, maybe, is that my principal at my first school actually pulled me aside. And I was teaching at this failing school in London, and I was madly trying to control the young people in my class. You know, I was working on relationships, et cetera, but I was very much on the behavior management side of the fence. Like, I was really trying to control their behavior. And he pulled me aside and he said, "Shai, you know, you've got so much potential as, you know, a fantastic educator, but you focused on the wrong thing." He said, "Focus on the learning and everything else will fall into place." He's like, "You create, you know, craft experiences where learning is at the core, where every single young person in your classroom can engage with that learning, and all the other stuff will fall into place."
If I was a school leader and we're sitting down once again, me having a coffee and you having a green tea, how do I make sure that my school is a place where self-regulated learning is something which is really embedded throughout the teaching and learning?
Perhaps the first thing that comes to mind is that, and this is a question that I get from teachers often, is how can we teach others to self-regulate their learning if we're not self-regulating our learning very well? And so perhaps as a leader, one of the first things that we need to do in leading a culture of self-regulated learning is to perhaps do the inner work and make sure that we, first and foremost, you know, are really connected with our identity as a learner and what that means in terms of what we say and what we do. And secondly, that we're transparent in the way that we self-regulate our own learning. Whether that's in a meeting, whether that's in a classroom, whether that's in, you know, a board meeting or something like that.
Yeah.
It could be in any of those environments. Yeah.
Absolutely. And there's no way, Shai, that we'd be able to unpack the entirety of your work or the great work you're doing with your podcast or your book in a short conversation. But my hope is that after this discussion, people are encouraged to check out your work and also pre-order a copy of the book. And I don't say this lightly, but it really is one of those books that has changed the way that I teach and also changed the way that I lead. I'm not just recommending it because it's a nice thing to do. And so my hope is that people would click on the link and go and pre-order a copy and stay in touch and follow your work. And for those people that are out there that want to find out more about your work, where's a good place to start?
Thanks, Matt. You know, there's plenty of options. The website's a good place to start, so shaiandbar.com. And you know, you can contact me through the website. I've got some free resources there for teachers interested in getting their hands on something straight away. Of course, social media at shaiandbar. I'm very open to chatting, you know, so if you've got questions, you know, reach out, don't hesitate, just say, "Hey Shai, just, you know, I heard you on the podcast and I want to connect." We'll bounce ideas. I'm always happy, you know, school leaders or teachers who are not sure where to start, more than happy to bounce some ideas for where it might be a good place to start for you.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Shaiandbar, thank you for your time. I really do appreciate it. And it has been an absolute privilege to get to catch up and might even do a round three in a couple of years. Who knows?
Next book. Mate, yep. Appreciate it. Really do. Thanks for the chat. We'll talk soon.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the podcast episode today. It's a privilege to get to share these conversations with you and continue to invest into our incredible profession. If you have a few moments, please do me a favor and leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or through whichever platform you're listening today. If you wouldn't mind also hitting the subscribe button and sharing it with your networks, it would really help to get the word out to as many educators as possible. There are different ways to connect in the notes below, including links to the website, the Facebook group, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you again for taking the time to listen. It means the world.